For James Belding, the co-founder and CEO of Tokenized, the launch of his desktop app just days ahead of the London Blockchain Conference was the fruit of years of work. Described as a self-custodial and enterprise-grade digital wallet for issuing, managing, and holding digital assets, including Bitcoin SV, Tokenized boasts an elegant interface, an easy sign-up process, and an impressive range of functions. I wanted to find out what Tokenized can do, and what's changed for James since we first met.
You're listening to CoinGeek Conversations with Charles Miller.
Well, James, I have to say welcome back to CoinGeek Conversations. Great to see you again.
Great to see you again too, Charles. Thanks for having me back.
Well, I looked recently at our first interview in 2019. Seems like a long time ago to me. And you talked about the development of Tokenized. You were going to put 40 different asset classes on it and make them available. And that's kind of come to fruition now.
Yes.
Feels maybe not 40, but...
not quite there yet. So at the time, and it sort of is true today, most of those, what we call them instrument types now, we think that's more accurate, are sort of fleshed out at the protocol level. But the real challenge is building a user experience that's really compelling, that kind of takes all of the unique elements of a particular instrument type across its life cycle and kind of delivers an experience that makes sense to users and is termed correctly and has all the automatic triggers and things like that. So there is lots of instrument types available at the protocol level. It's just where the challenge is actually building the app kind of level of it. So
right. Well, I've downloaded the Tokenized app. I've transferred 2 pence worth of my Bitcoin into it, and it's all went incredibly smoothly. And I see now that what I can do is issue tickets to events and various other things. So, I mean, you really are open for business. But that's comparatively recently, I think, isn't it?
Yeah. So we launched, I think it was 5 days ago now, 5-6 days ago. Yeah. So that was the big launch. Feels like it's been a tremendous mission to get here. We really put our blood, sweat, and tears into it to make it as compelling as we could, as simple as we could, as one of our philosophies. But yeah, right now anyone can download the app and they can use it as what we think is probably the best Bitcoin wallet or even crypto wallet in the whole industry now. And we think that for a number of reasons, but security mostly. So we really think that we've got a compelling security model that has much bigger implications than just in the crypto industry. We think this is sort of the go-to security model for all of finance going forward. Big reductions in fraud and things like that coming.
Is that an emphasis that sort of emerged as you developed the product, or was that always part of the plan?
So it was always part of a plan, but there was more of an instinct that this was important. And so kind of my reasoning centered around the idea that custodians still, even though you have a custodial relationship or custodial platform, you're still relying on some bit of information coming to you to instruct you how the user wants that money to move or what you want to do with their assets. And so you fundamentally got the same problem. A custodial relationship, they can add some due diligence checks and they can be a bit more suspicious about certain requests. You're like, does that actually make sense? Does it fit within the grand scheme of things? But we thought fundamentally, you're just kind of pushing the problem down further stream and you're not really getting anywhere. So we saw a non-custodial approach that kind of removed the platform and tech elements from it and allowed users to connect directly with the DLT as intuitively very compelling from a security point of view. And then we had some evolution in our thinking as we went through, you know, exactly where do we store these keys and what are the processes, where do the keys move, and how do we manage the information?
I don't completely understand how that works, but am I right in thinking that what you're doing is trying to use what Bitcoin itself can do in terms of security and cutting out these third parties that you might otherwise be?
Yeah, so you're recording. So everything, the philosophy behind what we're doing, and it has implications for that question, is that we're trying to put all the records of consequence onto the blockchain in a time-stamped sequential.
Which means they're independent of you as a business.
Correct, yeah. And it means that if our business were to fail, all those records are still available and they can be retrieved and they can be made sense of. It also means there's a high level of interoperability. So if you have other platforms that want to take reports or coordinate on key commercial events, they can do so in a very trustful manner without a lot of coordination in terms of interoperability. But one of the important parts of those commercial records is the authorizations. So who did what and why kind of thing, right? And that's really at a Bitcoin level is a key, public key and a private key, using it to create a signature to say, this is what I want to do. I want to send this amount of Bitcoin to this address. But that principle, really a digital signature, can be applied to all kinds of commercial records. So authorizing additional digital shares to be issued, authorizing secondary transfers, authorizing votes being cast on a resolution that's been proposed by a corporate entity, and you're using the tokenized shares to signify that you're a member of the company and that you do have the right to vote and things like that. So if you really sort of start to break down all these commercial events and commercial actions, there's always an authorization component. There's relationships between who's able to be, who's related to an entity, what their rights are and roles and permissions are, and extends out beyond the internal sort of company. It also extends to the shareholders and agents and advisors and things like that. So we started to really distill, take all these really sort of fundamental commercial ideas in terms of record keeping and look for opportunities to simplify, streamline, make it more elegant.
It's interesting because you've really had to analyze at a very abstract level what these different commercial operations consist of. And it's almost like an analyzing a language or something, isn't it?
To find what
they have in common and what the key distinctions are.
100%. And there was quite some surprising kind of patterns that emerged that we even didn't see at the beginning. But as we were working through it, we're kind of like, wow, this is exactly the same thing, but just slightly called slightly different thing with a slightly different convention and a lot of patterns like that.
So you must have learned a lot about business and contracts and everything.
Definitely. Yeah, it's been heavy.
Well, the other thing that people need to understand is the distinction between the open source tokenized protocol and your tokenized commercial operation. Perhaps you could just tell us about that.
Yeah, so the protocol is what we hope will eventually be called like some boring ISO number standard. So a messaging standard is a more common way of thinking about it. Or EDI, electronic document interchange. These types of concepts are all pretty similar, but really you're just defining data structures and methods that everyone can understand so that when they're sharing data and communicating and performing things, it's
this is like email versus an email like Gmail or something.
Correct.
That is your own version of it.
Exactly. So if you take that analogy, email would be like our smart contracting protocol. So that's the open source part of it. We want everyone to use it. It has tremendous value in being interoperable. And then our platform is like a commercial offering like Gmail, where we use that protocol and we provide our users with a streamlined, value-added experience.
What you're doing is inviting commercial competitors to come up with a better way of accessing the tokenized protocol than you are offering yourself, which in a way is an invitation to competition.
Yeah, but we think that's also a kind of a core strategic element to convincing big financial players to try us. And, because fundamentally there's no vendor lock-in. So we're happy to try and compete on merit, out innovating anyone else. And that's where we think we can stay ahead and carve a niche or carve a space out. But we think it's a very difficult thing to kind of deal with legacy infrastructure that's so entrenched and there's so many interests that are, want to keep that thing in place. We have to have a really, really compelling value prop to kind of justify the expenses and the overheads to kind of move over to a new system. And so de-risking it for them, say, hey, yes, we are a small startup. Yes, we're ambitious, but who knows, maybe we won't be here in 20 years. Someone might get an accident or something along those lines. So what you can feel comfortable with is there's a better value prop. There's something that works now. So you can try it out and you can use it and gain value from it, understand it. But also you have the ability, the option at all times to go and build your own competing platform or your own piece of it to kind of de-risk, lock in with vendors.
Right.
And things
so
like
there's
that.
There's a very specific commercial benefit in being able to approach big clients, potential clients, and say, yeah, okay, we're just a small company, but you don't need to be putting a big bet on our survival because the protocol will continue to exist and you can access it a different way.
Yeah.
And so how is that working out? I mean, what sort of stage have you reached with those kind of conversations?
Yeah, so I think that resonates very well. I think it's a major, even for myself, if I were going to use some kind of software for our company, are they going to be around in 12 months? Are they a successful business? So I think it's a really powerful message and we've got a lot of positive feedback for it. We're in active discussions with a lot of big players that are working their heads, you know, getting their heads around it and things like that. I wouldn't say we're at a stage where one of the biggest players is ready to drop everything and throw in there, but we're basically at the point where I think a bunch of pilot projects are going to start rolling out quite soon. And in all honesty, we probably weren't ready for it until fairly recently. Like, it was just too much groundwork to get done to kind of tick all the boxes.
Because I mean, it's taken a while, but I mean, and there's always kind of snide comments on social media about, you know, why is this taking so long and, you know, what's going on there? I mean, that must be kind of annoying to have to see that kind of thing.
If I put myself in their shoes, you know, sometimes, especially if you have a different vision for what tokens should be, and a lot of people have a fairly narrow vision. It's just a toy, something you can quickly click, and it's an image or something quite trivial.
NFTs and things.
Yeah, so I think a lot of people have that image in their head or that vision, and that's what they're comparing us to. Why does it take that long to get something like done? And I think that's a fair comment. Like, we should have had something like that a long time ago. But our vision is very, very different. And I think we're really leading in a really significant way about what smart contracts are and what this future 10x improvement really is. And the tokens themselves are tiny, tiny pieces of the puzzle. We think they're fairly, like, you know, any kind of instrument that you just make a token on chain, maybe it's a 5-20% improvement over current things, but the real unlocking of value and where all the hard work is in the smart contracts and all the implications that kind of arise from those.
Right. I mean, I guess there must be a sort of typical thing for any entrepreneur with a startup as to how perfect the product is before you launch it.
Yeah.
Would you just sort of get it out the door and improve it as you go along? But you've waited till you've got something really nice and kind of finished, I guess.
Yeah. And that was a very contentious position that I had. I had a lot of pushback on that. And it was a fight the whole time to kind of deliver what I thought was really important. But it wasn't... I don't think I'm a perfectionist in the sense that I was afraid of launching something that wouldn't be accepted or wasn't perfect. What I looked at was successful companies that had analogous components or business models to what we had. So the likes of Gmail, Slack are really important examples. And when I looked at their history, how long it took them to develop the core feature set and the quality app that they actually finally delivered and how it took off and how the word of mouth and reputation was built, I felt like a certain standard was important. And it was also a core set of features that just had to be there for things to be useful and to separate itself from other wallets and things like that. So I felt like if we'd come out with the 100th wallet that wasn't that good and that didn't distinguish itself at all from anything else, we wouldn't be able to get the momentum and wouldn't be able to get the recognition and people appreciating our vision to kind of get to the next stage. So I thought it was really, really important. And I think what we're doing is very different and we do need to lead and educate a little bit.
I mean, in terms of getting clients on board, I mean, they don't need to commit everything all at once, do they? I mean, you've got ticket sales, for instance, so people can kind of take tiny steps.
Absolutely, yeah.
Which I guess is helpful.
Yeah.
What kind of client are you most optimistic about being able to sort of tempt to try it out?
So I think obviously the BSV startup world has a lot of interest in various tokens like reward points and discount coupons to engage better with social media. They're all of their fans and customers on social media. I think it does represent a very frictionless and unique way of engaging with them, rewarding them, incentivizing them to kind of contribute to building the mission.
Those would be people with BSV wallets already, though.
Yeah. Or they can be incentivized to download a wallet quickly, right? And then receive these tokens. I think that's going to be something that we'll see quite a lot of soon. I still think the big money to be made and the big opportunity is really in bringing financial instruments on chain and transforming how the private markets operate.
It's not really it can function as a consumer product, but that's not where you see it really.
Yeah. So I think the Bitcoin part of it, I think for holders and for some, you know, transactions and consumer like behavior type stuff, I think it's a great product for them and it's supportive of a bigger vision that's coming. But in the short term, I think that's probably going to be the features and functions they're constrained to for the moment, just holding and just spending and buying things here. I think what really the discount coupons, loyalty points, and some of these other sort of more consumer focused elements, they become a lot more compelling and valuable in the future when we can build some more momentum, when you can get to things like going to a grocery store and having the payment be taken at the same time as you receiving the loyalty points or signing up for a loyalty program for the first time and having data shared accordingly, and then discount coupons applied automatically or you receiving to them. So that the whole experience is just happens instantly and it happens within your own best interest and you don't have to get out paper, you don't have to get out a separate card or give them the phone number every time. So we think there's a lot of friction that can be reduced ultimately. And it also means that users can have one app or a collection of apps that has their entire financial life in all of its details without having to have a separate app for this store and a separate app for this store and a different card for this store. So there's, I think there is a very compelling vision to come, but I think there's a few steps that we have to get in place before, and there's other lower hanging fruit to sort of tackle before that comes into play.
I mean, it sounds like your effort is going to go from software development to marketing in order to make those kind of things popular.
Yeah, I think there's a big challenge in marketing for sure. Just an education component.
So, yeah, because I mean, you could spend an infinite amount of money in trying to get everyone in the supermarket to use it, couldn't you? I mean, that's really ambitious.
Yeah. But I think those kind of things are highly desired by retailers, for example. They do want less friction. They want to be able to get the customers through faster because those things add 5-10 seconds to the process. And there is a lot of interest at in some of the bigger payment players and some of the bigger companies. I just don't think for us as a company and sort of all of the context that we have around us and things like that, that that's sort of a useful sort of stepping stone. I think we're going to have to build some credibility up before we get there and tackle it. And then it would be a matter of signing some big partnerships and embedding it into existing systems and infrastructure. Yeah.
Because, I mean, we're talking here at the London Blockchain Conference, and the whole emphasis here is on government and enterprise using the blockchain. I mean, is that the way that you see it going? And, I mean, you've been involved in this for a few years now. Where do you think we've reached in terms of those kind of big corporate entities and governments understanding what it's all about?
So I've seen in my own personal experiences a great deal of softening on the BSV front. So
what do you mean softening?
So going back, say 2, 3, 4 years, there was strong opinions that BSV was not serious, or they had a very strong opinion about something else like BTC or Ethereum or Ripple or whatever the coin that happened to be in their heads as the favored one. And those are very defiant kind of positions they had, right? And it wasn't necessarily the executives, but it would be the executives pulling their tech guru of the company in, and then the opinion would be expressed, and it would be sort of a no-go type situation. I think as the market has kind of, you know, been into a bear market, let's call it, and a lot of things haven't been delivered that were promised on being delivered, like Lightning Network, scaling, you know, Ethereum, moving past, was it 3 to 7 transactions a second they're still on, or 15, whatever it is. Just people are starting to feel let down, I think, a little bit. Those visions aren't coming to fruition. And so what I've seen is that in these conversations that previously have been very staunch and very confident are softening a lot. And they're a lot more open-minded to hearing other opinions and whatever else is out there and exploring it. So I've seen that in a few, a lot of examples, in fact. And then also I think what we have in terms of smart contracting platform, because I just do demos all the time and I show them, I think for a lot of those kind of people, they're familiar with the problem. They're very familiar with sort of the mechanics of smart contracts and post-trade kind of activities and the data elements of all these stuff. And so when they see it, it very much resonates with them.
So what is the problem that you are best able to define that interests them?
So I think the biggest is just driving significant efficiencies in terms of all of the key processes required of these contracts over the life cycle, right? So if you have in the private markets, which is where we're targeting, which is what I think where the biggest value prop differential is still like literal paper contracts with wet ink signatures or a combination of that and PDFs and Word documents, and then lawyers having their own copies and versions, all the customers having their own versions, their own document management systems. Then they have administrative type people, like often lawyers will pull those key details out of the contract. They'll go through it, interpret it, and they'll put those into registers and spreadsheets and reminders and calendar
events. So it's almost Dickensian.
Yeah. So it's awful. Even from a startup's perspective, it's just a lot of redundancy and extra data. And you get out of sync too, which is difficult because these are very consequential contracts, right? With big dollars sometimes behind them. So you think about all this complexity, all these tools, all these people involved, and all this room for mistakes and errors and lack of automation. What we're trying to do is take the entire stack all the way from the very beginning, which is the contract, the foundation of it all the way to the subsequent reports and secondary actions and things like that, and have a single source of truth that everything can depend on with more automation than was possible before and new insights that weren't possible before.
I mean, so, to make that work, there's a whole lot of different parties along the line who've all got to agree to use the system, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. So you're looking at like professional advisors as well as like the executives, the issuer, and then also the counterparties, like the holders.
If one link of the chain decides they don't want to play, then it's not going to work, I suppose.
Agree. And so our analysis on that is that the issuers are the most motivated to do it because it drives the biggest value for them, reducing costs in a real significant way, and just frees their mind up to do more interesting, more useful things with the business. And we think that, for example, lawyers and accountants that need to get involved, they'll just follow what the client needs. So if they have to log into a new platform and help, I think they'll get value from it, but they're not the ones driving change. It's the issuers for sure.
Right. Well, so you say you launched the app just very recently. What was that like? Do you have big celebrations? What does your team consist of? And do they see each other and celebrate or what?
We're all across the world. So we've got a couple guys in Cambridge. We got some guys in America, Australia. I'm in Australia as well. So different time zones, like that. I think there was a huge, everyone's really proud of what we've done. So, and I think people are working really, really hard for the last 4 or 5 months. So everyone's pretty tired and took the weekend off and just chilled out. But yeah, we're all buzzing and excited. And
when it was launched, you didn't discover any horrible bugs or anything that you didn't know existed?
No, we're pretty happy with that. So it was a pretty smooth launch on the whole.
That's it's worked for me. So I'm putting more money in it now. So
awesome.
Thank you so much, James. Really nice to talk to you again.
A real pleasure. Thanks, Charles.
Thanks very much to James Belding. I'm off for a few weeks now, but while I'm away, you'll be able to catch up with the latest group of entrepreneurs who I met from the London Block Dojo program. So please join me for those shows, and thanks for listening to this one. Bye for now.